Welcome to The Starfield, a podcast about space and the field of astronomy as seen through the lens of a student. I'm your new host, Sammy Mackey, an undergraduate at the University of Arizona. Before we begin the episode, I'd like to say thank you to our previous host, Hannah, for getting this project started. She has now graduated, so Hannah, from all of us at Active Galactic, we're wishing you the best of luck in all of your astronomy endeavors. Graduating with a degree in a field you're passionate about is, without a doubt, a huge achievement. Still, a specific kind of self-doubt often shows itself on the road there, and even beyond.
I know I've felt it. It presents itself as questions against your own validity in being where you are, despite past experience demonstrating competence and even excellence in your field. If you flounder your way through something you know you should have known, you may be faced with thoughts such as, maybe I've just been pretending the whole time. Now they'll know I don't actually fit, or do I really belong here? It even eats at you after doing well, like on an important test that others struggled on. I didn't do enough to deserve this. I don't really know these concepts. Or, I just got lucky.
Through our three segments, we'll discuss the pervasive phenomenon of imposter syndrome, specifically in the field of astronomy, talk to Dr. Leah Medeiros about her hand in expanding our knowledge about black holes with the Event Horizon Telescope, and learn why Dr. Impey has a pair of baby booties detailed with the JPL logo stashed in his office. As for the details, stay with us. One of the things that drew me to astronomy is how wide of an appeal it has. Astrophysicists figure out how the laws of nature work in space, mathematicians can see the sum of the universe in formulae, artists draw inspiration from the twinkling lights of celestial bodies, musicians hear the rhythms present in the cosmos. People have a genuine interest in exploration and discovery, and learning for the sake of new knowledge. Dr. Impey has a token of this sentiment in his office.
This item is would be easy to miss in this kind of busy office, but it's a pair of little booties of the kind that a total newborn infant would have. So they're, I don't know, from toe to heel, 4 inches long, out of wool, pale blue, and they've got written across the toe JPL, so it's the official JPL logo. So these are NASA booties from the Jet Propulsion Lab.
While not quite as easily recognizable as the NASA Meatball logo, the Jet Propulsion Lab initial logo is eye-catching. Bright red letters in a sharp-edged font. Still, the fact that it's emblazoned on a pair of infants' shoes is intriguing.
I mean, first of all, it's a slightly surprising item that you go to JPL, this place where they build billion-dollar space missions, and, you know, it's very techy and full of hardware, and they sell this kind of software, this very software for babies. So that makes you think, and it makes you wonder, you know, what kind of person buys JPL booties for their infant, their newborn? I mean, maybe a JPL employee, but they're selling these in the gift shop, so they obviously are for other people too. So it just makes me think about space, and it makes me think about people who are total space fans and acolytes, and, you know, that they wear the low. I mean, I go to meetings, and especially for public meetings where people are really into space, space nerds, if you like. I mean, and I'm a space nerd too.
So there it is. Regardless of one's pursuit of a degree or ownership of a telescope or any other benchmark, anyone can have an interest in outer space. There's even an annual event here in Tucson focusing on just that.
Probably Space Fest, which happens in Tucson every summer, is the best example of that. I go to that every year or so to give a talk.
From the Space Fest About Us page, their goal is to reach out to those who like space, but just don't know it yet.
And at Space Fest, they've had, I think 3 years ago, they had all the living NASA moonwalkers. So there are only 12 people that have ever walked on the moon. It's a pretty special club. Two are dead, and back then Neil Armstrong was still alive, but he didn't do it. He didn't sign autographs or go out in public. So they had everyone else. They had all the other moonwalkers, and it, you could tell the audience were like in awe. Well, that's a place where, you know, people would buy this kind of an item and have this kind of an item.
Even people working directly in and around the field of astronomy still get excited learning new things about space.
One of the fun gigs I have every year or so is there's a program. NASA has training for its employees, cross-training. Usually it's people, engineers, or people going into management, so to teach them management skills or project management. I teach astronomy, a sort of overview of astronomy, including their missions, of course, because it turns out, but I didn't realize, that a lot of the engineers who work on NASA missions, they go from mission to mission and they apply their technical skills, their engineering skills, and like nobody ever tells them, or there's no easy way for them to find out what that mission is doing, what's the science of that mission, and then more generally, what are all the things NASA is doing in science? It's a big agency doing a lot of things. So this three-day intensive course, 8 hours a day for 3 days, is a training for engineers, you know, 30 or 40 at a time, to learn what it is that NASA does in the science sense that's so exciting. And they're great people to teach because they're already technical. They're already, you know, you don't have to hold back on anything. But they don't know it. You know, they don't know about black holes. They don't know about supernovae. They don't know about life on Titan or Mars or whatever. So they're super excited. They ask great questions. You can tell they're happy to get a sense of what the science is behind all the hardware.
And really, what's not to enjoy about this? There's just so much to explore, and any reason to have an interest in learning about space is a valid one.
But these booties, I just thought, symbolized the new birth and new opportunity and so on, the possibilities of the future, the sort of belief in space, the sort of people who are total space fans, the idea that there's a new generation. You know, if you were born and before you were really conscious or sentient, you were wearing little JPL booties, you might well grow up to be an astronaut. You might well grow up to be an engineer and work in the space program.
The release of the images of M87's black hole was arguably one of the most astounding astronomical announcements within the last year. Such an amazing endeavor wouldn't have been possible without an idea of what we expected to find in the first place. This is where astrophysicists such as Dr. Medeiros come in.
My name is Leah Medeiros. I just finished my PhD. I spent most of my PhD working on research at the University of Arizona, but I have traveled around a little bit more than that as well.
As of June 1st, 2019, Dr. Leah Medeiros is an NSF postdoc fellow at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton.
Most of my research focuses on, it definitely focuses on the Event Horizon Telescope, but specifically within the umbrella of the Event Horizon Telescope, I usually focus more on the theoretical aspects, and so I work with simulations of what we think this black hole may or may not look like.
Dr. Medeiros has been working at the frontier of discovery by focusing on simulations related to our galaxy's black hole.
And specifically for the black hole at the center of the galaxy, I've been doing a lot of work on trying to understand how the variability that we expect to see from that black hole is going to affect our ability to make an image. So you've probably noticed that we haven't published an image for the black hole at the center of the galaxy, and that is precisely what I'm working on.
She didn't just one day find herself plopped in front of a computer running code for huge simulations, though.
I loved math from a very early age, so I moved around a lot from different countries when I was little, and so I'm originally from Brazil. Portuguese was my first language, but I moved to England when I was 2. And so then I moved back to Brazil and then to America, and it was kind of a mess. But the point of all of that is that by the time I was 10, I had kind of already understood that all of the subjects tended to change when you change to different countries and different languages, except for math. Math seemed like this more deep universal truth that it seemed like something that was actually worthwhile for me to kind of dedicate my time to. And so I focused a lot on math. And then when I was in junior year of high school, I was taking calculus, astronomy, and physics at the same time. And then that's when I realized why math is so universal and why it is so incredibly important, because you can use math to not only explain the universe around us, but you can actually use it to make predictions for objects that we had no idea could possibly exist, but then just based on math, we were able to actually predict that they should exist, such as black holes, for example.
She found an interest in the universality of math and followed that interest from math to science to black holes. Dr. Medeiros has been doing research in the field of astronomy for several years, has earned a PhD in physics, and, as mentioned before, she's an NSF postdoc fellow. But that still doesn't stop imposter syndrome from rearing its head.
So I feel like I'm an official professional physicist / astrophysicist, but some days I still feel like a child trying to learn basic things, but you know.
Dr. Medeiros' work mainly lies in programming and theoretical simulation, but it wasn't always like that.
So I did do some research as an undergrad, but it was nothing related to the EHT. And so I was not running simulations as an undergrad. I think in general, at least in my day, it was actually kind of hard to get a project where you actually got to run simulations as an undergrad. And so I did a couple more observational projects as an undergrad. And then it wasn't really until the end of my second year of grad school that I really started working on the EHT. I am working on a completely different algorithm that is not completely ready yet, but will be out soon. And it's actually kind of a machine learning algorithm in a way. And so I don't actually like to call it a machine learning algorithm because I feel like it's actually way too simple. But technically, if you actually look it up in a machine learning textbook, it technically is defined as a machine learning algorithm. And the idea there is that there's a black hole at the center of the galaxy, and that black hole is variable. And so the point here is that in general, there's stuff swirling around black holes, and all that stuff gets really, really hot. So hot that it becomes a plasma, and so hot that it emits a bunch of light. And so the light that we see is coming from this swirling plasma around the black hole, and then we're trying to see the shadow that the black hole casts on that surrounding emission. And the point of all of this is that because it is swirling around, it's variable, right? So things are moving. So if you're trying to take an image of something that's moving, it's gonna be harder. And the black hole at the center of M87, the one that we've already imaged, it has a mass that's about 1,000 times bigger than the mass of the black hole in the center of the galaxy. The one at the center of the galaxy is about 1,000 times closer. So as far as like the size, from our perspective, they look to be about the same size in the sky. So the size isn't a problem. What is a problem, though, is the fact that the timescale for this to vary also goes with mass. And so if you have a black hole that's 1,000 times smaller, it's the image that you're trying to get is going to change about 1,000 times faster. And so it's much harder to actually image the black hole in the center of the galaxy than the black hole in M87. And so my algorithm is trying to use simulations as kind of a training set and then trying to solve this problem that way. And then from a actual day-to-day aspect, I just love the challenge of trying to figure something out and the process of going from, oh, what's going on here, to, oh, maybe it's this, and then to, oh, hey, I actually figured that out. Like, just being able to go through that process and actually learn something new and see the progress being made, I think is really, really wonderful.
Alongside her fascinating line of study, Dr. Medeiros enjoys salsa dancing, aerial silks, ceramics, even rodeo. And she especially loves engaging with people outside of the field of astronomy.
So I love talking to the public about what I do and just getting other people excited about these crazy, amazing objects that actually exist that seem so far from, you know, the everyday life that we all lead, but they're actually real and they're actually right there. I mean, you know, 55 million light years away, but they actually do exist and they actually do send information towards us. That to me is just so exciting, especially when it's kids, just seeing the excitement and the wonder in their face when they learn something new is just really kind of makes everything worthwhile to me.
For those thinking about entering the field, she also has a few words.
So a couple things. I do think that trying to get as much of a math and science background as you can before you actually start undergrad is very, very important. So for me, for example, like I went so far as to take classes at a community college when I was in high school to try to get more, like a stronger base in math before I actually started college. And I think that that was really, really good for me personally.
And then we're back to that particular self-doubt.
I think that the main thing that I would like to say to like maybe an undergrad that might be a woman or identifies as some other minority is that there's a very real and present thing that a lot of people that I know, myself included, have dealt with in this field, and that's called imposter syndrome. And I just think that for me as an undergrad, it would have been very useful to just know that this is a real thing and that it's not just you. And that just because you feel like maybe you don't belong doesn't necessarily mean that that's true. And maybe you should be a little kinder to yourself and focus a little bit more on things that you feel like you're doing well. Or if nothing else, just take, you know, a deep breath before coming to conclusions that maybe you don't belong in this field. Because I can tell you from personal experience, I've thought about that so many times about whether or not I belonged in this field. And even just like when I was applying to jobs for a postdoc just a few months ago, I was like so sure I wasn't going to get a job, and I've gotten like some of the best jobs out there, and I'm like shocked. And so, you know, I really think it goes a long way to just be aware that this is a thing that exists and that a lot of people go through that. The other thing I would say is that it's hard, but it's hard for everybody. And I think that there are a lot of people that go into these fields expecting that to do well in this field, you need to be so incredibly smart that you just understand everything the very first time that you see it. And that's just not true. Everybody needs to work hard at this, and everybody learns in different ways. And so I think that determination and perseverance actually had a much bigger effect on how well things went for me personally than any, like, you know, talent that I was born with or anything like that. And I'm not saying that you don't, you know, have to be good with math. I'm just saying that being good with math is definitely not enough.
Even PhD-holding active researchers sometimes doubt if they still belong in their field. So rather than trying to convince yourself not to worry about it, keep in mind that you're in good company. The first question people tend to ask me if I mention I'm majoring in astronomy is, "Oh, so what do you plan on doing with your degree?" This is an understandable question. People like to know what you're going to be up to in the future, and it's an avenue of discussion. I, however, dread this inquiry because my true and honest answers are I don't know, and probably nothing directly related. I'm not studying astronomy to dive into research and discovery. In fact, I much prefer sitting on the side listening to all the researchers present their findings and then sharing what I learn with others. I also like taking my knowledge of astronomy and applying it to artistic media. Many, many times I've thought, maybe I'm not actually an astronomer because of this. But I talk to my peers, my friends, my professors, and I've heard all of them say they've felt, and in some cases, still feel, the same exact way. I've still studied to be an astronomer, the same as my peers, and I still belong in this field. Perhaps you're also struggling with imposter syndrome, be it in astronomy or some other line of study. Communicate with those around you. They're probably in the same boat. And if that doesn't quite do it for you, here's an anecdote from Neil Gaiman, writer of many, many wonderful stories that I stumbled upon a while ago. He had been attending an event several years ago that called for a gathering of great people from all lines of work, artistic, literary, scientific, and more. He ended up meeting an older gentleman who happened to share his first name, Neil. The man confided in Gaiman that he felt he didn't fit in with the general gathering of creative, discovery-driven attendees, and that he just went where he was sent. To which Gaiman replied, "Yes, but you were the first man on the moon. I think that counts for something." Here, I'd like to quote Gaiman's eloquently worded conclusion to this story. "If Neil Armstrong, the first man on the moon, felt like an imposter, maybe everyone did. Maybe there weren't any grown-ups, only people who had worked hard and also got lucky and were slightly out of their depth. All of us doing the best job we could, which is all we can really hope for." In undergrads, doctors, astronauts, and storytellers alike, imposter syndrome exists. Still, at least in my experience, astronomy presents us all with ways to engage in forms of thought, whether imaginative creativity or investigative research. If you've watched Active Galactic's video on the collection of stars once known as Aljazat, or read up on the history of constellations before Greek and Roman influence found their way into global astronomy, you may have gotten a taste of how old some stories are. The night sky has been populated with the thoughts of people for as long as there have been people. Space belongs to no one. We all share its lights, and we always have. It's present for everyone, so regardless of the reason, anyone can have a love for astronomy. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Starfield. This episode is produced and hosted by me, Sammy Mackey, in partnership with Active Galactic, Teach Astronomy, and the University of Arizona. For more information about Active Galactic or the topics we've covered, check out the links in the podcast description. Many thanks to Dr. Leah Medeiros for interviewing with us this episode. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a rating and review on iTunes, Spotify, or whatever streaming service you use. Until next time, this has been The Starfield.